Good afternoon. Today I am very excited, and I'm also, I would say in Yiddish, a shtickle, a small drop, petrified, because we're going to tackle a different topic than we've ever done, in a different style than we've ever studied before. But when I came across this idea recently, I thought to myself, how could we miss the opportunity in this context, in the context of thinking about spiritual resistance and the Holocaust, of talking about this, even though it's not going to be an easy conversation, and some of the ideas here are probably quite controversial. So that's going to be something we're going to deal with. But before we do that, I think in a certain respect, as you'll see, before we do that, I don't know how many of us have ever studied in a traditional base medrash in a yeshiva, but for many of us...
So you want a show of hands?
I'm not going to ask for one. One of the major places that people go for study when you think about learning in a yeshiva is the study of Maimonides, of the Rambam. You know, traditional Talmudic learning finds its way by one way or another to Maimonides. So I would actually like to recreate for the moment as if we were right now in a Beis Medrash. Maybe that Beis Medrash was in Vilna 75 or 85 or 95 years ago. And I want to share with you a passage of the Rambam, because our goal today is actually going to be different than what we often have done. In the past, we've often looked at different cities, and I wanted today, instead of looking at a city, I wanted to look at this one Rambam. And as is often the case, this is how many rabbis make a good living. This is a difficult Rambam. And so what we need to do is resolve and understand this comment of Maimonides. That's going to be the end game for this discussion. If we can do that, then we're good. So this Rambam appears on page 1 of your packet. The Rambam makes a statement, and there is a parallel statement that appears in other Midrashic literature. The Rambam, Maimonides, is living in the second half of the 12th century. He's born in 1135. He dies in 1204. He writes this toward the end of his life. His magnum opus, which is known as the Yad HaChazakah, the strong hand, the Rambam's 14 books. And in the end of the section of the laws of Purim, the holiday that we just recently observed, the Rambam teaches, Kol Sifrei HaNaviim, all of the books of the prophets, V'kol HaKsuvim, and all of the writings, Asidin Libata Limos HaMashiach, Chutz MiMegillas Esther, are all going to somehow become null and void in the future, except for the book of Esther. Because that is going to exist as the Torah itself, the five books of Moses that God received at Sinai, and that will never be forgotten. This passage of the Rambam patterns and follows a tradition that we have that appears in Midrash. A Midrash is a collection of teachings from the Mishnaic and Talmudic period, so you're talking organized between the 3rd century and the 5th century, that describes that holidays are going to be disbanded in the Jewish tradition in the time to come, but Purim will not. So many commentaries struggle to understand what this means. What does it mean that somehow other books of the prophets and the writings are going to be, put into the back shelf of the library? I don't know what they're going to do with them. And the whole holiday of Purim and its book, that is going to be eternal. That is the difficulty that we need to figure out in this Rambam today. Let's put it on the back burner for a second. We're going to fast forward from the Rambam many years to page 2, where you have a section. This comes from Esther Farbstein's book, Hidden in Thunder. And what you're looking at is a facsimile of an underground newspaper that was published in Warsaw in the spring of 1942. What is the title of this anonymous work? which the newspaper was known as a Kol in Der Midbar, which means a voice in the desert. That's the Yiddish phrase. That's the name of this underground newspaper that was published in Warsaw. You see on the bottom. On the top, you see the top of the facsimile before the underline, the top letters. It's a little hard to make out. It says, Mechias Amalek. The eradication of Amalek. What is Amalek? Anybody know what Amalek is? Right? The people who attempted what?
To destroy the Israelites during one period of time, but especially when they were leaving Egypt.
Exactly. Right after they were leaving Egypt, most famously, the first people to try to destroy the Israelites. Already you're thinking, you're putting the connection together. And in the top line here, after the underline, Gedenk vot Amalek hot dir Giton. Remember, Gedenk, remember what Amalek did to us. There is a commandment in the Torah, directly in the Chumash, in the five books, to remember that which Amalek, this nation, did to the Jewish people as they were leaving Egypt. So this anonymous author in the underground, in the ghetto, is writing a pamphlet calling, charging the Jews to remember that which Amalek did to us. So first of all, Esther Farbstein, in her research, quite interestingly, identifies who the likely author of this was. And that was a man by the name of Rev. Alexander Zusha Friedman, who was later killed by the Germans. But at this time, he was very active in the underground, in the Aguda, especially in the world of publishing. I actually have at home, and it's not uncommon, before the war in the 1930s, he published a collection of Torah ideas, kind of like a potpourri catch-all on the weekly portions. And it's called Mayana Shel Torah, the Wellsprings of the Torah. It used to be a great, at least when I was growing up, it was a big bar mitzvah gift. And I got this gift as a bar mitzvah, and I sat on my shelf until, I don't know, a couple of years ago when we started getting together. And then I kind of put two and two together. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is the same Rav Alexander Zusha Friedman from the Warsaw Ghetto. Anyway, amazing story.
Was this part of the, what was the name of the historian?
Ringelblum's Onik Shabbos Archives. Yes, this was saved because of the Onik Shabbos Archives, as well as some other rabbinic writings that we are familiar with that we've talked about in the past, whether it's Rabbi Shimon Huberband or Rabbi Clonimus Kalman Shapira. Okay, so this is a contemporaneously written document, and it's written at a specific time. When is it written? February 1942. Why is he writing in February 1942 about remembering Amalek?
Purim Haman was from Amalek.
That's right. You want to say it again louder so everybody can hear?
Somebody said Hitler was from Amalek.
Ah! So that is the parallel that, let's assume that it's Rabbi Friedman, Rabbi Alexander Zusha Friedman, that is the parallel that he's trying to draw for the Jews in the ghetto. He's telling them, my friends, we're facing an enemy whose purpose is to annihilate us. And this is one of the earlier documents that acknowledges a systematic program of annihilation, because in many circles, even at this time, there was not a full grasp among many people, even those living in the ghetto, that there was already underway a program of systematic annihilation. So this message, this way of phrasing the communication to the Jews, is to draw on a specific biblical reference and to give people a heads up. Listen to what is happening here. They never use, she describes Farbstein, he doesn't use the word Nazis, probably for specific reasons, and that's true in other writings elsewhere of other people in the spiritual world of resistance. He doesn't use their name, but he's trying to pull on this reference to educate people to understand what's happening. So she summarizes on the next pages, 3 and 4, you'll see.
It's all written in Yiddish.
Yeah, it's all in Yiddish.
Also the fact that they would use the biblical references kind of as code words to the community so that because they, in case there were spies or whatever. We've had that discussion, right?
Yeah, so this is something which is it's a well-known theme if you know what you're looking for. If you know the biblical story and you're living in Warsaw, when somebody says, remember what Amalek did to you, that's immediate. And the truth is, you already figure that out instantly, that is the message, without it being even articulated. So what this becomes then, and it's being described here on 40 and page 3, and then it goes over to page 4. You can read it on your own later, of course. You see the section on the next page, on page 4. Many nations have waged wars against the Jews, done evil to them, but Amalek is something else entirely. Amalek made the annihilation of the Jews its goal, its program, its principle, deliberately in cold blood, sadistically, according to a plan, in an orderly manner, through laws and clauses, and the decree was issued in Shushan. She then describes how the article talks about Judaism and not just Jews on the top of the next column. And then it talks about the idea of a spiritual response to Amalek, which is something that you can read on your own. In and of itself is worthy. Once, maybe a couple of years ago, we talked about this passage in a different context. But this is also interesting, that the response to Amalek is a spiritual response in this context, not a military one. But what I'm pointing out here is that during this time, you notice that there is this link that is being drawn between Amalek and Hitler and the Nazi regime and the Germans, and that's the narrative that's happening during the war at that time. Now let's fast forward almost 15 years. Come to New York, where you have the opportunity to learn from arguably one of the greatest rabbinic luminaries of the last century, one of the greatest Jewish leaders. And at this time, he is now an honorary president of the religious Zionist organization, the RZA, of the Mizrahi. His name is Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik is living in Boston, and he commutes to New York, where he is a Rosh Yeshiva, maybe the highest rabbinic authority in Yeshiva University. And he also is responsible for ordaining hundreds and then thousands of rabbis and shaping the future of our community. My teachers are students of Rabbi Soloveitchik. And Rabbi Soloveitchik delivers addresses at a sequence of Mizrahi convention, of religious Zionist conventions in New York over the course of several years in the 1950s. Later, he delivers a very important talk, which is published, called Kol Dodi Dofik, which means, literally, the voice of my beloved is knocking. This article talks about the knocks that God is knocking on our door with the state of Israel, and how the state of Israel is a divine gift, and it represents six different knocks and how we need to respond to that. In the context of this very lengthy essay, Rav Soloveitchik addresses the Holocaust from a bunch of different vantage points. One of the issues that he mentions is, in his view, our, using his word, our collective failure as American Jews for not adequately speaking up on behalf of European Jewry. That is one issue that he raises in the context of Kol Dodi Dofik. He's speaking now in the 1950s, 1956. Much later, reflecting back and saying, we should have done more.
Yeah, right. Okay.
That's what he's saying now.
We should have learned the Holocaust.
Yes. Now.
So can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
That's what I was always wondering. So what's his answer to why they didn't do it?
So he doesn't have a good answer. He doesn't have a good answer. And this is something that when we spoke maybe last time or two times ago, we spoke about the Vod HaHatzalah and the activities of those rabbis and the March on Washington, that there were some attempts. It wasn't that there weren't any attempts. There were some attempts, but Rav Soloveitchik felt that it was not adequate. And we can't judge, because we're living in 2018 in a totally different, a whole different milieu. But that's one remark that he mentions. In the context of that discussion, he quotes his own father. Rabbi Soloveitchik was a giant, a Talmudic giant, a Torah giant, who is a descendant of giants. His father was the late Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik. Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik was the rabbinic leader of Yeshiva University. At that time it was Yeshiva College, of Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary until his death in 1941. That's when Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik took over for his father. His grandfather was Rabbi Chaim Halevi Soloveitchik of Brisk, one of the most influential and transformational figures in rabbinic life and learning over the last few hundred years. So Rabbi Soloveitchik comes from maybe the finest, you could call it, religious and spiritual pedigree. In this context, take a look on page 5 in Kol Dodi Do Fake. In this context, he's talking about the struggle to defend Israel against Arab onslaughts. Go to line number 5. Go to 5 in the packet. The top of the page says Kol Dodi Do Fake. The little page number from the corner in the published edition, it says 98 on number 5. Next page. Yeah, it's a skinny page. Line number 5. He says the following. At a Mizrahi convention, I cited the view expressed by my father and master, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, of blessed memory, that the proclamation, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation, does not only translate into the communal exercise of waging obligatory war against a specific race, but includes as well the obligation to rise up as a community against any people or group that, filled with maniacal hatred, directs its enmity against Knesset Yisrael, which means the Jewish people. When a people emblazons on its banner, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel be no more in remembrance, it becomes hereby Amalek. In the 1930s and 40s, the Nazis, with Hitler at their head, filled this role. They were the Amalekites, the standard bearers of insane hatred and enmity during the era just past. That is an extremely bold statement. The footnote here in the back, which I didn't put in your packets, the footnote here in Kol Dodi Do Fake cites a passage from Maimonides from which his father deduced this idea that Amalek is not just, or is not specifically a nation that we have to identify who attacked us and tried to annihilate us when we left Egypt. It's now saying that the Nazis may not have been descended from the biblical Amalek, but they are now personifying, or even they become the new Amalek in our generation, and we have the obligation, and the very complicated discussion in biblical and halachic literature about destroying, eradicating Amalek completely. So we see that this theme, which was first articulated earlier, I shouldn't say first, but articulated very clearly in the ghetto, is something that Rav Soloveitchik reflects on, again, associating the persecutors of the Jews and the Nazis with Amalek, with our arch enemy who sought to completely annihilate us. And if this wasn't a strong enough connection, I want to turn your attention to the next page. You have here the cover of a remarkable volume, which is really quite amazing, and it's the art scroll biography of a man by the name of Rabbi Yisrael Zev Gustman. Rabbi Gustman was the youngest rabbinic genius living in Vilna, and was a member of the rabbinical court of the greatest rabbinic luminary of the time at the beginning of the Holocaust, none other than... Thank you. Rabbi Chaim Ozer Grzesinski. Now Grodin. It's Grodzin, but used to be Grzesinski. Rabbi Chaim Ozer Grzesinski was the undisputed leader of world Jewry. And he had a rabbinical court that met in Vilna. He had a Beis Din. And Rav Yisrael Zev Gustman was a young genius who was a member of the rabbinic court of Rav Chaim Ozer in his early 20s. It's really quite amazing. He was a student of a very important yeshiva before the war in a place called Grodno in Poland. And this volume is published posthumously by a man by the name of David Page. And I love this idea because he describes how he came to Israel and he found out about Rav Yisrael Zev Gusman. If you go to Rehavia today and you go down Rehov Ramban at the corner of Ibn Ezra, there is a beautiful shul building, yeshiva building. That's Rav Gusman's yeshiva. It still exists today. It's called Ramles Yeshiva Netzach Yisrael. And you could just drive past it. You wouldn't know the whole story of what this man's life was all about. This guy comes to Israel and he starts finding out. Rav Gusman had died 25 years before. He had never met him. But he was so blown away by his personality that he decided to seek out his top students and his family members to get the story of Rav Gusman. So Rav Gusman was living in Vilna and he was regarded, yeah.
This was the one that you told us the story about the Shiva, right?
Yes, this is the same man from the Shiva with Professor Alman, yes. And other stories like that. You know, he broke all boundaries. We did once a discussion about breaking down boundaries in different communities and stereotypes. So, you know, if you looked at him, maybe you wouldn't suspect the kind of worldview that he had. Somebody once asked him why he went to a Yom Yerushalayim parade where there was, you know, all the young Bnei Akiva kids were all walking there. They tell the story in the book. And they said, why are you going there? You know, don't you have better things to do? And this was a man who was an unflinching masmid, you would say in Hebrew. He learned 24/7. Sometimes preparing his class, he would go one or two nights in a row without sleeping because he was busy learning. So he said, what my eyes saw happen to children, and for me to come to Israel and to see children parading Yerushalayim, there's no greater joy than that. So he had two children and his wife, and they were trapped in Vilna in the ghetto when the Germans came. He describes how he had his son, his name was Meir, he was 4 years old, and they were hiding together, and a German found him, and he took his... beat the son until he died in his arms, and he had to go bury it, clean and do the tahara for his own son and bury him and sell his shoes for food. It's, you know, indescribable what he had to endure. And his daughter, who was a little bit older, at one point said to him that we need to run away. We can't stay here. We're not going to survive here. So they did. They, in the cover of darkness, were able to actually escape the ghetto and they went to the forest. And they describe here various things that happened to him when he was in the forest and how for several months on end there was a farmer who put them in a pit and dropped down some food every day. An unbelievable description. So turn to page 6.
What you're just saying is in this particular book?
Yes, it's in this volume. And you see on the left side, he describes how he stayed in a hotel for a night. Why? Because there was a farmer who, after 6 months, let them sleep on hay in a barn. And he said it was like sleeping in a hotel. And he describes how, on one occasion, they found a pea in the forest. One pea. And thinking about how he was going to divide it up. So he took half of it for his daughter and half of it for his wife. And how they were so parched. And it's unimaginable what he describes. But what is also amazing is that this man, who was, again, one of the greatest rabbis of the generation, describes the following on the top second column. When Rav Gusman reached the forest, his plan was to become a partisan to fight against the Nazis and defend himself and his family. However, to be accepted as a partisan, there was a single condition. One had to bring a weapon. Rav Gusman's opportunity came when he saw a lone Nazi soldier passing through a quiet place in the forest. Rav Gusman jumped the soldier, threw his rifle as far away as he could, and killed the soldier with his bare hands. In Yerushalayim, Rav Gusman would look down at his hands and say, I was Mekayim, I fulfilled the mitzvah of being Moche Zecher Amalek, of wiping out Amalek with my bare hands. Hands. And then they tell a lighter story because he used to go to Gush Etzion to vacation where he would write his magnificent, unbelievably complex lectures on Talmud that were published, most of them in his lifetime, called Kuntres Eish Yurim. So he would go to the Gush and he saw he saw a soldier dismantling and cleaning his gun. And Rav Gusman said, I could do it much faster than you, from his experience in the forest, he joined the partisans. After the war, just so we should appreciate, after the war, what happened when he was liberated by the Russians? He went back to Vilna, because he said they need people, they need help. So he became a rabbi, found a few remnant of Jews, and he tried to reorganize Jewish life in Vilna after the war. Imagine, it's impossible to even fathom the greatness, the moral fiber of this man, until one night a Russian officer came to his door and said that tomorrow someone's going to come and knock on your door and take you to the gulag. You better run away right now. So that's how he ended up getting tipped off by a Jew who was in the Russian army. I don't know if it was in the secret police or in the army. And then he fled to America. He lived in America, then he made his way to Israel. So Rav Gusman describes that he saw Amalek with his two eyes. So this idea that Amalek, this arch enemy of Israel, exists in some form, in some fashion, the ultimate of evil, is what these three stories are teaching us. So what I'm going to suggest to you is that with this idea, with these three stories in mind, we can understand the Rambam. How are we going to answer the Rambam with these stories? With one more source, source number 7. You ready? Now you have to use, to do this, remember we started by talking about the fact that if we were in a Beis Medrash. One of the most important tools in a Beis Medrash is your thumb. You have to be able to use one thumb and a second thumb at the same time. You ready? So we already pointed out with one thumb the difficulty in the passage of the Rambam, that Maimonides claims that all of the books outside of the five books are going to be nullified outside of the story of Esther. Now, on the other hand, we're going to quote now a tshuva, a responsum of the Rashba, Rabbeinu Shlomo of Barcelona, Rabbeinu Shlomo ben Aderet. He was also very, very influential, very important rabbinic leader of Spanish Jewry in the 14th century. Now you're talking about 200 years after Maimonides. He's living in Barcelona and he receives queries from Jewish people all over the world. And he writes back to them and he collects them and he publishes them. We have several thousand answers to questions. They are called she'elot u'tshuvot, questions and answers. So someone, you see, and this is the first volume of Shilos and Tshuvas of responsa of Rabbeinu Shlomo ben Aderet. In the underline, she'alta, you asked, number 93, that it says in the Medrash that all of the holidays are going to be nullified except for Purim. I don't understand. How could that be that all the holidays are going to go by without Purim, except for Purim? So you see the second underline in the Hebrew word, it says teshuva. That means his answer. Tshuva means his answer. He says in Hebrew, Dvarim nosafim od bahagadazu. There's more to this answer. And that is that some have a tradition that Yom Kippur, the high holy day of Yom Kippur, will also not happen. That will not be lost. Everything else will be gone except for Yom Kippurim and Purim. Notice those days sound very similar. So he says, what's the answer? Go to line number 8. I'll translate as we go in the Hebrew. Al kain, therefore, nira li, it seems to me, pirusho, its explanation, shekol ha-moadim lo hiftiach aleim yizbarach shelo yigrom ha-chet bitulam. None of the holidays are promised by God that they will not be missed due to chet, due to our mistakes, our misdeeds, a punishment. Be'echad min hazmanim. And he quotes a verse in Eicha, except for the holiday of Purim. There will come a time, says Rabbi Shlomo ben Aderet in the 14th century, that because of our shortcomings, which is a traditional Jewish motif that's appropriate in many settings, although probably not so much in the Holocaust, according to most, but let's leave that for a separate discussion. There will be a time when the persecution of Jews will be so bad they won't be able to observe the holidays. But Purim, they'll still be able to observe. That's the answer of Rabbeinu Shlomo ben Aderet. So you have the Rambam, who says that the Megillah is going to last, and the Rashba says that Purim will last. How will it last? It will last despite all persecutions. Does that answer work for you? Does that work? How many people ate Hamantash in February of 1942 in the Warsaw Ghetto? How many people read the Purim Haggadah? You know, not many. So came along a great Hasidic master whose name was Reb Tzadok HaKohen Rabinowitz of Lublin, living around the year 1900. Reb Tzadok HaKohen Lublin says, I look at this Rambam and I look at this Rashba, and he says, I don't understand. If Jews can't eat matzah, this is again before the Germans come around, but he's saying there's going to be a time. There will be times when Jews will be so persecuted that they can't eat matzah on Pesach. Well, if they can't eat matzah, they can't read the Megillah either. What does it mean that Purim is not going to be taken away?
Ghetto and then Rav Guzman, like, he was able to fulfill Purim with his two hands, even though
yes,
nothing else was available to him. He couldn't do anything else, but he could still fulfill that mitzvah.
Yes, and Rav Tzadok HaKohen takes it even further. He says, what is the main mitzvah of remembering Amalek? It's exactly that. It's remembering what they did to us. It's identifying evil and calling it out. Recognizing it and never being okay with it. It's a memory. We read the portion every year, so you should remember that story. Based on what we're saying and the whole effort that we have to study spiritual resistance, I think that what Mrs. Schreiber is alluding to is maybe the answer to this Rambam and this Rashba. Because the Germans could take away everything from the Jews except for themselves. So this, says Reb Tzadok, is the answer. That Purim, and he says that's the same thing for Yom Kippur, your spiritual experience of Yom Kippur, it could be very powerful even if you're not in the synagogue, even if you don't have matzah and a sukkah, because what happens in Yom Kippur happens in here. So he says that's what it means that Rabbi Shlomo ben Aderet says that Yom Kippur they can never take away from you, even with persecutions. Because they can never take away what's happening in here. And he says that is the same thing for Purim. The idea of Purim, this letter that we got from Rabbi Alexander Zusha Friedman, Hashem Yikom Domo, he's telling the Jewish people, we might not be able to read the Megillah this year, but we could still remember what evil is. And we could still remember that we're not that. And that we need to call ourselves to something much more noble. And that's the answer to the Rambam. And that's the answer to the Rashba. That the story of Esther is the story that we won't be bowed by people who are pure evil. And we will remember it. And we're going to tell that story even if we don't have a scroll. Even if we don't have anything internally, we could tell that scroll. We could tell that story because we can create that meaning. Who articulated this the most clearly, although maybe he didn't know about this comment from Reb Tzadok HaKohen? Probably, your next page, Viktor Frankl. Yes.
The mitzvah to remember Amalek?
Yes.
Out against it.
So the answer is, it's two components. The first component of destroying Amalek, it's very difficult to know how what that means. How to identify somebody who's Amalek. It's the most extreme expression in this story of Rav Guzman, where he actually felt that he fulfilled that with his hands. But there's a separate mitzvah that we today still fulfill. Oftentimes we in the synagogue, we call it Parshat Zachor, the portion of Zachor, which means
remember.
Remember what they did. Zachor, remember Eis Asher Asalacha Amalek. Remember, and that was, if you remember, what was the title of that monograph published, A Kol in Der Midbar? It was Gedenk, remember. It's the same thing. They're playing on the same idea. So they're saying, even if we're in the ghetto, we could still observe Purim. Because Purim is the story of Haman, who's descended from Amalek, trying to eradicate the Jewish people. And we're going to remember that. And through remembering that, we create meaning. So in the first, I gave you three small selections from Viktor Frankl. Go to page 8, the next page. It's the first in the gray. My Xerox came out a little gray. This intensification of inner life, he's describing here how when he was going through various parts of his suffering, he was remembering his wife in his mind. You know, that was the image that he kept with him. This intensification of inner life helped the prisoner find a refuge from the emptiness, desolation, and spiritual poverty of his existence by letting him escape into the past. When given free rein, his imagination played with past events, often not important ones, but minor happenings and trifling things. His nostalgic memory glorified them, and they assumed a strange character. Their world and their existence seemed very distant, and the spirit reached out for them longingly. In my mind, I took bus rides, unlocked the front door of my apartment, answered my telephone, switched on the electric lights. Our thoughts often centered on such details, and these memories could move one to tears. Go to the next page. He describes here the difference between the outer and the inner. What they could take away from us, he's talking about the physical and sociological conditions of lack of sleep, insufficient food, mental stresses. In the final analysis, it becomes clear that the sort of person the prisoner became was the result of an inner decision and not the result of camp influences alone. Fundamentally, therefore, any man can, even under such circumstances, decide what shall become of him mentally and spiritually. And this is, by the way, this is the whole underpinning of the rest of his book, of logotherapy, of therapy by creating meaning. And not so much, it's not psychoanalysis talking about what happened years ago, or even what's happening out there right now. What's important is what's happening on the inside. Last page. Last section. As we said before, any attempt to restore a man's inner strength in the camp had first to succeed in showing him some future goal. Nietzsche's words, it's interesting that he quotes Nietzsche, "He who has a why to live for can bear to live for can bear with almost any how," could be the guiding motto for all psychotherapeutic and psychohygienic efforts regarding prisoners. Whenever there was an opportunity for it, one had to give them a why, an aim, for their lives in order to strengthen them to bear the terrible how, their existence. Woe to him who saw no more sense in his life, no aim, no purpose, and therefore no point on carrying on. He was soon lost. The typical reply with which such a man rejected all encouraging arguments was, "I have nothing to expect from life anymore." What sort of answer can one give to that? What was really needed was a fundamental change in our attitude toward life. We had to learn ourselves, and furthermore, we had to teach the despairing men that it did not really matter what we expected from life, but from what life expected from us. We needed to stop thinking about the meaning of life and instead to think of ourselves as those who are being questioned by life. Next paragraph. "These tests, therefore, the meaning of life, differ from man to man, moment to moment. Thus, it is impossible to define the meaning of life in a general way." So he says it depends on the person, who it is who you're talking to. But the principle of the matter is still the same, that it's the internal compass that's going to guide the person forward. It's obviously an incredibly powerful tool for people today in everyone's life during various vicissitudes that we have to encounter. But it's his analysis of what kept people going, and I think that is really the explanation that the message of Amalek and the remembering of Amalek and all of these, whether it's Rav Gussman or Rav Soloveitchik or Rav Zusha Friedman in the ghetto, what they're trying to tell us. They didn't have the ability to wipe out Amalek with arms, although Rav Gussman did defend himself with his hands. But what they were saying was that Amalek is an idea that they can't take away from you. Purim will never be gone because there will be people who will set out to completely annihilate us. And we have to remember them. We have to remember what evil is and what goodness is. And that's going to be the ultimate barometer for our internal moral compass. And that no one can take away. That's why Purim is eternal. That's why the story of the Megillah is eternal. And ultimately, there's one last note, which is the note of hope. And that's kind of also what Viktor Frankl is getting at here. If you have no hope for anything in your own life, so then there's going to be ultimate despair. But if there is hope for something, it may not even be external salvation. But the idea, the end of the Megillah, in that case, they were actually saved from Haman, the descendant of Amalek. But to say that there is a mitzvah of remembering, that is the unique mitzvah of Amalek, primarily. And that we still do every day. So to remember the concept of evil, and to identify it, to be able to look it in the eye, and not, as it says in the Megillah, not to bow in front of it, that is an ultimate expression of resistance. And that's something that you can see in the museum in different ways, but certainly this is a Jewish kind of fundamental way of looking at remembering Amalek so that you can look it in the eye and resist it, even if you can't resist it physically, but you can resist it spiritually, psychologically, and emotionally. Yes, Shel, what were you
saying? The word Zachor appears so many times in the Bible.
Yes.
It's a continuing phrase that we are to remember. Don't forget why Jews do not, for the most part, not put that word aside. And why are we continually to remind you? Because we know what evil is. We've faced it enough times. We recognize it. And you can't put it aside just because somebody else says, why do you continue to foster that idea of destruction? You find, I think, that people who want to make Judaism and its attributes somewhat negative, they cite this Purim story of Amalek as a way of saying, these aren't the peaceful people. You can't cling to yourself the concept of being a peaceful piece of literature or rabbinic law, because look what you do, women and children. You kill the animals even. You destroy the trees even. Every civilized people would not do something like that. So there's something wrong with you folks. You can't cling to that idea that you are above that. So I take a great deal of heart out of something like this. It's the first time I've ever heard this, to be honest with you. It reinforces my own thinking.
So what Shel is pointing out is that there is many religious, Jewish, traditional rabbinic authorities have struggled with what does it mean that there is a mitzvah to eradicate Amalek? What does it mean there is a mitzvah to eradicate Amalek today? What did it mean back then? So it is a difficult question.
Right.
But the idea that there is this evil in the world and that it needs to be totally eradicated, because the notion of coming to completely annihilate our people, as you said, somehow it doesn't disappear over time. That's the
And the reason that it continues to succeed and reappear over the generations in many forms is because someone was kind enough not to wipe out that particular family because they were clinging to their young and their and they were suckling their newborn,
mm-hmm.
and we took heart and we didn't kill them. And guess what? There they are, 100 years later, 200 years later, the same group of people that we were so kind to.
So that, and, exactly, and that is what many commentators point out, is the story of the narrative of King Saul
exactly,
and the downfall.
Exactly.
That's exactly the story.
Yeah, exactly.
So the question of what...
I'm not lecturing to you by any means.
No, that's it. And that's the question of, you know... Yeah.
When you first brought up the idea that the Book of Esther is one book, my first thought was, you know, when we say in the Haggadah, Shabbat Haldar.
Yes.
That's what occurred to, that's what I thought, because Haldar Vadar, Omni Malayna Lachadar.
Exactly. It's a perpetual challenge that we face, that people are trying to eradicate us. Now, there's a good reason that they're trying to do that. We understand why they want to do that. Because, you know, some people don't like a nation that has a moral compass, that brings a sense of consciousness of what propriety and morality is in the world, which was obviously, as you know, you can articulate that upstairs in terms of underlying causes for why the Germans picked out the Jews. Obviously, it wasn't just the Jews, but there's a primary message here that says, I think, I don't remember if it was in Mein Kampf or somewhere else, Hitler, Yimach Shemo, I think he referred to Jews as the conscience of the world.
Yes.
Right? I think it was in Mein Kampf.
Yes.
So some people don't want that. So they're going to do everything in their power to completely eradicate it. But that will never, and that's why, you know, whether you talk about Amalek as a nation or an idea, it's the idea that there is an anti-godliness, pure evil, that says that we want to eradicate all consciousness of goodness and morality. And what the Jewish people are standing up for in every generation, whatever iteration that is to say that we believe that there is a God in the world and that there is a right and wrong. And that's what we're going to remember when we remember Amalek. You cannot ever conflate, you know, this is part of the challenge today. Just ask Deborah Lipstadt, right? Mm-hmm. It's the conflation between truth and untruth and right and wrong. We are going to remember Amalek because we are going to remember, and we will not allow any denial of that idea that there were people who absolutely tried to annihilate us. Because ultimately, that's going to perpetuate. That's the ultimate struggle of good and evil. Yeah. If you want to frame it like that, you could definitely say that what he was saying in this criticism was, now we recognize, or maybe we did at that time but we didn't step up enough, was to realize that this was Amalek staring us in the face and we didn't stand up to the challenge. That's exactly it. We didn't remember that enough to proclaim it, to protest enough. And he writes there, it's very sharp language he uses, and it's self-reflective. He says, we could have saved more. Don't say, oh, we couldn't have done anything, it wouldn't have made a difference. He says, yes, it would have. And we didn't do it.
That's the argument. Very often people will say to why we didn't take out the tracks, or why we didn't take out this or that. Well, 2/3 of the people were already eradicated, but there was still 500,000
all the Hungarian Jews.
And so you can't accept that as an argument that has any validity.
Exactly. And that's why he says, no one could say that. He says, we could have, and his point is to say, even if we would have saved one. Like, isn't that the beautiful image at the end of Schindler's List, where he looks at his watch and he says, maybe I could have saved one more with this watch? Think about that, right? The Gemara says, the Talmud says in Sanhedrin, that what one person, that meaning. So yeah, we can't excuse that. Yeah.
Rabbi Silver, who was the Reform rabbi, was the head of the Jewish community, basically during the Holocaust. Steal and tear hay, don't make a lot of noise.
So that was Rabbi Stephen Wise, that many people, right? So Rabbi Silver was in many instances very opposed to Stephen Wise, and they had a lot of back and forth. In that book that I mentioned last time from Zuroff, from Effie Zuroff, Dr. Zuroff, he talks a lot about the tension that they had. About, and there's a lot of controversy, and far be it from me to judge Stephen Wise. That's not my place. I'm not qualified to do that.
Okay.
But definitely, there is a lot of controversy about whether there was or wasn't enough done, given the circumstances and all that. It's another discussion.
My question
is, Dina.
Okay, so Purim, we remember Amalek.
Yeah.
Pesach, we were slaves in Egypt,
right?
And we celebrate freedom. Why
yes.
can't we remember Pesach as well?
Okay.
As Purim?
So, good question. So we're definitely going to remember Pesach, and it's so important to remember Pesach that the rabbi said, you know, there's this thing. One day, some people are going to do. They do something called the March of the Living, and the rabbis in the Talmudic time said to themselves, probably, why would Jews go on the March of the Living? And you'll excuse me for saying this, but why would they go prop up the economy of people who, and I don't care what the Polish legislature says or doesn't say about what they did or they didn't do during the war, you know, why would we go back there? Well, the answer is, obviously, because we know that taking young people, or people of any age, and seeing something with your own eyes to experience it yourself changes how you remember it and how you learn it. So you know what the rabbis said 2,000 years ago? They said, you know, the Exodus was such a life-changing experience. That memory is so important. Let's do our own version of March of the Living at your dining room table. Let's take out food that will remind you of that episode. Let's tell a story that will remind you of that. But don't tell the story in a lecture format from a book. Let's create an environment. Let's have some parents get dressed up and throw plastic frogs at each other. Let's have little kids ask questions and get excited so that they can learn in an experiential way so that they can taste the story. And that's, of course, why you make a Seder. So the Seder is actually the child-centered education, experiential learning concept that we have. Because remembering Pesach is obviously of utmost importance. Of course, Pesach was also a big motif for people. I think One time, I think we talked about Zelig Kalmanovich and his description about Pesach in the Vilna Ghetto. So Pesach is also a big motif. But maybe this motif is something that, when I was putting this together and thinking about it this year, when I came across this idea from Rav Tzadok HaKohen Rabinowitz, I'm like, we have to talk about this. Because it's such an amazing concept that he's alluded to, he's foreshadowing to years before, that no matter what the persecution is, Zechira, remembering, which is the way that Purim is referred to in the Talmud, as Yamim Ha'ila, these days are Nizkarim V'Na'asim. First you remember the message of Purim, then you do it. That to me was so powerful.